Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did with T. Scott Wooten, actor, stage manager, director, and playwright. He's here in Florida directing The Chosen for the American Stage Theater Company in St. Petersburg, Florida. This is a companion piece to the piece he directed last year for American Stage called My Name is Asher Lev. This is an unusual interview because, as I will say in introducing it and as I say during it, I talked to Scott for probably a half an hour without recording it. So I'm playing catch up in this interview, and that makes it somewhat interesting. So hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice, oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive.
The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about self-discovery. In a way, it's about courage. The courage to ask yourself the question, am I all of who I really am? Am I living the life that my innate nature, my innate talent, my given essence would have made possible? Or was there a lesson that I learned from my family of origin, from a teacher in school, from the culture I was raised in, from my siblings or my peers, from my religion, from something I read or heard, from some traumatic event that occurred in my life that told me not to be who I really am? Was there something that happened to me early on in my life that discouraged me from pursuing the things that turned me on? Maybe even something I knew that turned me on at the very beginning of my life. If you've been listening to my interviews, then you know that so many of the people that I interview, people who make their living or their life with an art, knew at two what they were meant to do, what they were drawn to, what they had passion for, what they yearned to be part of. I played the interview with Joyce Valentine, who sat down and played at two what her mother had been teaching a seven-year-old student. This was not negotiable. Joyce knew that the piano was the place for her, virtually from the time she could stand, apparently. And this is not that uncommon. I hear this story a lot from musicians, ironically. People who started playing at two or three or four. But I also hear this from fine artists, people who picked up a pencil or a crayon or something and were doing amazing things with it and could not actually be parted from it. I think it was Gail Fulton Ross who tells the story of how her mother had to put her crayons and drawing stuff outside, otherwise she couldn't get Gail to go out. And so it's just not uncommon for people to discover so young, so early in life, what they are drawn to, what they have a passion for, what speaks to them. I think it was Kate Alexander, a brilliant actor, who told me that she remembers sitting on a stage. She had gone to see a performance, and she was on the stage with her feet hanging over the stage, thinking, this is where I want to be. I think she was seven. She didn't really know what acting was, but she knew that she wanted to be there. So, this is not uncommon, and yet, unfortunately, few of us are given the encouragement to follow our natural inclinations. And this doesn't just apply to talents, abilities, skills that we might have been drawn to or attracted to or that spoke to us. This is also true, perhaps even more true, to ways of being. Did you laugh out loud at the kitchen table? Did you laugh so hard at the kitchen table that food spilled out of your mouth or your nose or something? And then were you told in no uncertain terms that that kind of laughing is a bad, bad thing? Leave the table or just don't do it or something? And so did you decide that a certain kind of explosive joy was not for you? That you were not to feel that, express that? Did you get angry or hurt or cry or frightened? And did you hear from a religious person or a teacher that that was not good behavior? You were not to get angry. Anger was the devil's something, or was unattractive, or didn't get you anywhere, or or maybe you were even punished for it. Go to your room. Who do you think you are? Don't do that. And of course, this applies across the board to every kind of behavior, every kind of impulse. Did you want to read all the time? And did someone tell you that that was not okay? I interviewed a writer once who told me that he would write these little stories when he was quite young, 6, 7, 8, and hide them around the house. And that his mother found one of them, and in it he had said some things about a neighbor that weren't true, it was fiction, but they weren't very nice. And his mother was horrified and forbid him to write again. In this particular case, it didn't do any good. This was Stuart Kaminsky, who prolific doesn't begin to describe Stuart's output. And unfortunately, we could have had so much, much, much more from Stuart, but he died much too young. But he did leave us a huge, huge legacy. And if you're not familiar with Stuart Kaminsky's work, especially if you like mystery fiction, run right out to your local library and read Stuart Kaminsky. So we hear these things, we get these experiences, things happen to us in our childhood which discourage us from, sometimes just from completely expressing, exploring our passion. But for many, it's not just an interruption, it's a flat-out denial. You will not be like that. You will not do that. That is not okay. I won't love that. So I won't love you if you are like that. And that's, of course, how we interpret it. Or that's dangerous, or it's ugly, or it's evil. And so too many of us are forced, in order to survive our childhoods, in order to be okay in our childhoods, to hide, pretend, deny aspects of ourselves. I'm a psychotherapist, in case you couldn't tell and didn't know because you're listening for the first time. So I am a psychotherapist, and of course this is my bias. My bias is that we have the right to be what we would have been if we had not been discouraged. And that it is never too late to ask the question, was there something I could have been, might have been, should have been? And what was it? And how did I lose it? And it is my belief that we never lose it. That all those things that we are go underground. I call it undercover. We bury them deep inside ourselves, but we don't lose them. We can't amputate parts of ourselves. So they're always there, and they're always waiting. But because they were hidden as a result of our deciding that they were ugly or dangerous or would cost us something we weren't willing to lose, it's hard to recover them, because the recovery, the attempt to recover, also brings back the taboo, the early learning, the discouragement, the pain, if there's pain attached to it, and usually there is. I'm treating a number of people whose the experiences of their first couple of years were so unpleasant that their ability to feel safe is undercover. Their ability to not be vigilant every minute of the day is undercover. So, it is the intention of this show, as well as the intention of all the work I do, to make this point, to say, you may be living a cover story, that's what I call it. That's the version of yourself that was acceptable. It's the truth, but it's not the whole truth. It is likely that you have buried some aspect of yourself, and that your life is poorer because of that. It's obvious if you can't feel safe, if you have to be worried, watching, and vigilant every minute of the day, how much richer your life would be if you didn't have to do that. But it's also true that if you were a natural artist, that sitting with a blank sheet of paper and a pencil or a crayon or a pen, the hours melted away and you created something that you could see evolving and that brought you the most delicious joy, and that somehow you lost the permission to do that, you can see how much richer your life would be if you could get that back. So this is the intention of the Lynn Show, to encourage you to ask the question, is there something? And if there is, the chances are you actually even know it. And then to ask the question, am I willing to try to recover it? Because it really does take courage as I said, when you go after the recovery process, you get back whatever it was that stopped you. So it can be difficult. This is, of course, what psychotherapy is all about. This is, well, one of the things that psychotherapy is meant to do is help us to be all that we are. So you might want to think about that. You might want to read the article that's up on my website called Psychotherapy on the Go, which talks about what it's like to do psychotherapy on the telephone, which is how I do it these days. And at my website, you can also get the podcasts of all the shows, listen to any of the interviews that I've done before, including the one you're going to hear now. You can get a copy of my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. You can ask me a question by clicking on Email Me. Just ask me anything you like. You can get me to come and talk to your group or organization. There are lots of things to do on my... Oh, but of course I have to tell you what it is. It is thelynshow.com. THELYNNESHOW. Thelynshow.com. Don't leave the E off of Lynn. And now, as I do every week, I'm going to play an interview. I interview, as I said, people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you hear a person who has done that talking about their connection to their art, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. This interview is, of course, no exception to that rule. T. Scott Wooten is passionate about his work. What makes this interview a little unusual for me, and you will hear me talking about it during the interview, is that I talked to Scott for easily a half an hour, maybe longer, and then noticed that I had not been recording it. So we start again, and as a result, you miss a lot of what I heard from Scott, the run-up, the experience that led him to become what he is, director, stage manager, actor, playwright. I'm going to say a little bit about that here. We talk a little bit about it in the interview I actually did record. Scott was a cut-up as a kid. He liked to make people laugh. He liked to entertain. He liked to put on performances. And he did that with his friends and with his sister. And he thought he would like to be somehow an entertainer. So when he applied to college, he got in as a broadcasting major, assuming that he would be something like a weatherman. However, then he saw a performance of a play by Molière. And he was so struck by it, so moved by it, that he understood that it was actually theater and not broadcasting that was his passion, that was his love. And he changed his major to theater. After he graduated, he was fortunate enough, and again, you'll hear us talk about this or allude to it, to be accepted as an intern at the American Stage Theater Company in St. Petersburg, Florida. At the end of year one, Todd Olson, the then producing artistic director for American Stage, said to Scott they liked him very much and would he like to stay for another year. At the end of that year, Todd said the same thing, and so that went on for 9 years. And during that time, Scott got an opportunity to do essentially postgraduate work in theater. And you will hear him talk about the development of many skill sets, because he did everything. And now, as a result, he can do pretty much everything there is to do in the theater. And as a result, he's a working theater person, an anomaly, actually. So he directs at least one play for American Stage every year now. And the one he's directing now, as I said in the run-up, and as you will hear us talking about, is The Chosen. So I think this is enough of a sort of explanation for the truncated version of my interview with Scott. And now, here he is, T. Scott Wooten. Okay, so I'm here with T. Scott Wooten, and he's going to tell me about The Chosen, which he is here
directing for the American Stage Theater in St. Petersburg. So do you want to tell me about The Chosen?
Sure. It's a play that takes place in the 1940s, and it's about two friends from disparate ends of Judaism who become friends amidst the end of World War II, the horrors of the Holocaust, and the birth of the State of Israel. That's it in a nutshell.
Okay, so from so are you saying there's an Orthodox and a Reform Jew, or is it somebody who believes in Israel and somebody who doesn't?
Yes, one family has a Zionist bent, and the other are a Hasids.
Uh-huh.
So you have a very big divide between the cultures.
So is there a conflict for them personally, or is it?
Yes, and that's what we're still discovering in the rehearsals. It's a major conflict for them at first because it's like one will look at the other as the other, and you don't socialize with them,
right.
And there's no coexisting with them, even though you know they're there. That's their world, and you know.
And even though you know that you share something pretty significant with them, they are still the other, and in that way, taboo, or mm-hmm. like that?
Yes. And especially once the more Zionist sentiments start arising, well after, you know, the few years after World War II ends.
Okay, so as the sensitive director, what is it about this play that would call for a sensitive director?
I think it's because it's a story of fathers and sons more than it is about the conflicts that arise with the pro-Zionists. It's a father-son story because it's all about the path that your father would choose for you and the path that you choose for yourself. And kind of the very sensitive way that you get older and you break apart from what your parents expect you to do. And then you gain the confidence to do something that you feel a calling to, as opposed to the calling to religion. So that's where I would come in tonight.
So it's a coming-of-age story?
Yes. They're 15 at the beginning, and we see them graduate high school and go into college, and then graduate college, and then what? Where do we go now? Do we go to seminary, or do we go get our master's in a secular subject, you know?
Right. Okay. Is this like Asher Lev?
It is, because there are common themes. The Hasidic world is prevalent in both, because Potok was part of that world, and they both have to do with a familial break with the son over something that has secular ties. So I would say that that's how they're the most similar.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I need to say now that I've been talking to Scott for probably 30, 40 minutes, and didn't record anything he said. So we have a half an hour, and so what I'd like to do in that half hour is recap as much as we can of your life. I've never done this before, mm-hmm. So what I would like you to do, and again, I've not ever asked anyone to do this, so what I'd like you to do is think about what you say. Scott told me the story of how he became interested in theater, then in acting sort of, and then committed to directing and stage managing. So I wonder if you could look at that, just look at the trajectory, and say what comes to mind. What do you see as what were the highlights, the high points for you? Some of that you may want to be telling me again, but mm-hmm. So when I'm asking you this, what do you find yourself thinking?
I would say the highlights of that would be probably being exposed to acting and being kind of theatrical at an early age. Being really moved in my first year of college by a production by a Molière French production comedy, being so moved by that to become a theater major. I always say I feel very lucky that I got the internship right after college, too. Of course, I did work for it, and I put my fishing line out to try to get it, and I did get an internship. And I'm very proud of that, and I'm very proud of my success of that first season and being able to be a staff member at a regional theater.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just curious. I didn't ask, while you were telling me the story, where were your family on this? Did they, when you were first a bee, you know, in the first production in first grade, did they say, oh, you're a terrific bee? Or, you know, when you decided to major in broadcasting, were they, did they say, oh, phew, you know, good, or when you decided to major in theater, did they approve, did they disapprove, did they like it?
I don't think they were ever surprised by it. I mean, they were always very supportive. They were always very supportive, and they always thought that I was doing something presentationally theatrical for the benefit of getting laughs or something. I don't think they were surprised at all. I think that when they thought I was going into the news business, that it would be like, oh, okay, you'll be a weatherman. That's fantastic. And then whenever I changed the theater, I just think that they thought, okay, great. Well, you're discovering what you're called to do. So they've always been very supportive. It took a good 5 years for them to really understand what I do after college. Because I don't come from show people background. I come from, humble means and rural Arkansas people. So.
Well, wait. So this is kind of interesting to me because you said in the thing I didn't record that 60 people started out in that theater class of yours and only 3 graduated.
Yeah.
And one of the things you said about why some of those people didn't graduate is because they realized that making a living in theater was perhaps not a secure way of making a living.
That's being kind.
Yes, right, right. And so they, and their parents wanted them to have something secure, too, right? So one might have expected that if you had come from show people, they would have understood that and maybe, you know, been generous about it. But people who didn't come from show might have been expected to say, are you kidding?
Yeah.
You know?
I think my parents were the happiest that I was even going to college because it turns out that I was the first Wooten of my family to ever go and graduate college.
Wow.
So that's a milestone.
Now, did you know that when you went
in?
I did.
And it's one of those things that's hanging over your head, but it's like, you know what, I'm expected to finish college and I'm going to do it, by God, you know. Now, that's not to say that my mom didn't try to push me into medicine and law, which she did.
Yeah.
And dentistry, and I said, that doesn't excite me. I have no attachment to going into medicine or going into law. I don't want to do that. I want to do this. And so it there was some pushback, sure, but they were still supportive.
Well, what's interesting to me about this is if for you to be able to say to your mother, you know, that just doesn't turn me on. Really, what turns me on is this thing. This is what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Suggests to me, anyway, that earlier in life, you got the sense from them that you could do what you wanted to do, that they approved of you, that they appreciated you, that they valued you. Do you know what I'm saying?
Sure.
I mean, a child who had been, I don't know, told what to do, chastised, whatever, might not have been able to say to his mother, well, I'm really sorry, Mom, you know, the law doesn't turn me on.
Yeah, yeah.
So is that accurate, do you think, that they just thought you were terrific?
Yeah, I mean, it was a struggle for my parents, and I didn't know it till I got older to have 2 kids at such an early age. My mom was 18 when I was born, and my dad was 22, and 3 years after I was born, my sister was born, and, you know, my my dad has always worked in factories, always been a machinist and those kind of things, and my mom got into medicine, and she is now a nurse, but she, I can never remember really what her title is. I just know she's a nurse, and she has a cardiology bent, and she makes a lot of money. That's all I know. That's all I know about what she does, but she is a nurse. And my father's a handyman now, and he works at a hotel. So, but it was a real struggle for them to raise two kids in Arkansas and be poor. Mm-hmm. In the 80s and 90s. And they were always wanting to make sure that we were having a good time and that we believed in ourselves and that we were going to not settle for something easy and keep striving for something. You know, I think being freelance, you know, you live out of a suitcase for 2 years and then you realize, yeah, that's what my parents were telling me, to try to fortify myself and don't settle, just keep moving and try to keep looking for it, whatever it is.
You know? It's pretty remarkable, I think, for the kind of people you're describing your parents were when you were born.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it sounds like your mother had it, because she went off and did her thing, right?
Right, right.
Right, and so, so in a way, she gave you that.
Yeah.
I mean, she would have preferred, I think, as you say, for you to have chosen something that was a little more financially secure.
Sure, sure.
Right? Okay, so as I remember it, Scott's story is the story of a kind of evolutionary arriving at first maybe acting, playing, making people laugh, telling stories, and then falling in love with the idea of having the whole picture and being able to tell people what to do,
mm-hmm.
and then finding himself sort of discovering stage managing,
mm-hmm.
and then really having what is a pretty atypical experience. I mean, you know, you get out of college, immediately you get the internship. The internship loves you, and then you stay there for, what, 9 years?
9 years.
Right? And then simply because you think you'd like to move on, you get an opportunity to go first to the other coast and then to Washington,
mm-hmm.
and it just keeps happening.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one thing, you know, one thing ends and another thing begins, and then another thing ends and another thing begins. You know that is pretty atypical.
Oh, yeah, I feel I'm very lucky. I've been working nonstop for 11 years now in the career that I chose in, you know, my focus in college. So I am very lucky that way. I know a lot of people don't, at least they don't endeavor to have a multi-skill set, but that's something Todd always was telling me, if he was like my graduate advisor, because like we used to joke around that I've done so much that I kind of got my honorary master's degree working here.
Mm-hmm. I just want to stop you. This Todd is Todd Olson,
mm-hmm.
who was until very recently the producing artistic director for American Stage.
Mm-hmm. And he was the guy that originally hired me as an intern.
Right, and kept you,
mm-hmm.
and apparently taught you.
Yeah, I totally look at him as my next stage advisor. And he told me, he said, you know, if you learn how to be a generalist, you will never stop working. You will always be working. So learn as many skill sets as you can in this business. If you love the business, learn all the skill sets you can because you'll always keep working.
Well, you already are working as a director and a stage manager, and you already have been working as an actor. But I remember that you identified yourself in the part that I didn't record as also a playwright.
Mm-hmm.
So are you writing? Are you?
Yeah, I usually write a play a year, and I've done that. I've written a play a year for probably 7 years now.
Really?
A lot of times, most are not. Well, I wouldn't say that. I'm getting to a point now that at least half of them have been produced.
Wow.
Yeah. Mostly it's. I had a big success with an adaptation of the Reefer Madness movie, and I did an adaptation called Reefer Madness the Play, because the musical is called Reefer Madness the Musical, mine's called Reefer Madness the Play, and we took it we produced it, and I was in it, and I directed it, and
where?
It was just an American Stage in the old place, and it was just a fun little, It's a fun little thing. Me and my friend Julie Rowe we self-produced cabarets and things, and one of the things we produced was my play, Reefer Madness play, and it's 60 minutes, and it takes four actors, and we did it, and it was a success, and so we did it again, and it was a success, and then we thought, you know, let's take it to the Fringe Festival and over in Orlando, because we know it works, and why don't we just take it over there? We take it over there, and it won the Best Play Audience Choice Award, and then this last spring, Eckerd College, the seniors of Eckerd College produced it for their senior thesis project, which I was really happy about. So I did that, and then I've been commissioned the last 3 years to write the play for the Suncoast AIDS Theater Project's yearly fundraiser in June around Pride Week. And they tell me what they want written, which is an adaptation of a movie or something. So, and then I get the idea, I write the book, and then I hand it to Michael Raby, who's my music director and co-writer, and then I say, I don't have any input on what you're going to add to this.
So does he write songs?
He writes songs.
Music and lyrics?
Yeah, he writes music and lyrics and throws them into the play, and then it becomes a musical, and then they perform it, and they raise money, and 100% of the proceeds go to the
Suncoast AIDS.
Yeah, and it goes to people with AIDS, mm-hmm. Charities. And so we just did All About Steve, which was All About Eve adaptation, and then the year before we did Blown by the Wind, which was Gone with the Wind, and then the year before we did A Wizard of Oz, which was The Wizard of Oz. So and it's raised over $10,000 for the charities, which is really great.
Yeah, that is really great, mm-hmm. but... So, now these are all adaptations. Have mm-hmm. you written any original stuff?
Oh, yeah, I've written a few original things.
What do you write about?
Oh, all kinds of stuff. I always say, you know, I only write because I do consider myself a playwright. I used to say, I'm a writer of plays, because I would write thinking, you know, this is just an idea that I really like, and I just want to write it, so I'll write a play. And I don't really ever intend for it to go anywhere. I don't intend to hand it to somebody and say, okay, you produced this. I always just think, well, I'll hold on to it, and one of these days, if I have some time, I'll produce it. But, you know, it's this and that. It's just stories that, they're original stories that I don't know, for one reason or another, I just feel like it's a part of me that I have to get out. And I'm realizing when I look back at plays I've written, even the plays I've been commissioned to write, they all have. There's always something in it that is directly autobiographical about myself and something I happen to have been going through when I wrote it. So there's always something in these plays that have something to do with that.
Well, that's really interesting. Now, it's not particularly surprising for that to exist in stuff that you write, you know, that is original.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they do say write what you know, and so theoretically mm-hmm. what you know is what's going on inside of you at the time. So
yeah.
It wouldn't be so surprising to hear that you would write from that. Mm-hmm. But to hear that, I don't know what, serendipitously, the things they ask you to write also trigger something that's going on inside of you at the
yeah,
time.
Yeah.
That's pretty interesting.
There's always some reason why I am writing it in the first place, and you know, it's therapeutic, I think, for me, just to get out ideas, you know. I always like to say, the theater that excites me is to watch passionate characters arguing passionately to an uncaring world. You know, it's people that really believe in something and really arguing about it passionately and just trying to yell from the mountain. And whether it's espousing personal philosophies or trying to change the world, you know, I don't know. That doesn't really concern me. But there are little tempests and storms that I feel in my heart or in my head, and it's just like, you know what? This would make a good play. I'm just going to write it down as a play. And then I've got that.
So that is the... I don't know what, the through line or the basic theme that comes out in your work.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because you don't present like that.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you know that.
Yeah.
You present as kind of an easygoing,
yeah,
okay kind of guy.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I see. So we'll have to see those plays to know what's going on inside.
Can you give me a grant to produce them? I'd love to produce them.
Well, I mean, that's not an impossible thing.
Yeah, it's not impossible. Who knows?
What are you thinking?
I don't know.
Well, you'll let us know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I will be very happy to run this interview, however odd it is, to promote a play of yours.
Sure, sure. Yeah. Well, Reefer Madness has gotten lots of attention and production, so it's available to be produced by anybody who wants to do it. It's tried and true.
Okay.
Just call me.
Yeah. Yes, and you can get in touch with T. Scott Wooten by, do you want to say? Do you have a website or something?
I don't have a website, but anybody can find me. It's tscottwooten@gmail.com.
Fine. Okay, good. All right, so now The Chosen opens on...
September the 5th is opening night.
Okay, and it runs for, do you remember?
It runs to the end of September.
Okay, all right, fine.
Mm-hmm.
And people can get tickets by going to americanstage.org?
.org or 727-823-PLAY.
Very nice.
P-L-A-Y.
Very nice. And so do we know what's next for T. Scott Wooten?
I've got a couple of irons in the fire for a couple of possibilities. We'll see. I mean, I think that once the show opens, I'll most likely be heading back to D.C. to continue work there. So, but who knows? I've got feelers out. I'm planning my world conquest, you know, little by little. So.
Well, you know, if the past is any predictor of the future, you don't have to worry.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
No,
I'll
we're
take
so
it
I'm,
as a blessing.
I'm really looking forward to seeing this. And the other question that I ask is, having given a life, and you really have given your life to theater here, is there anything you would say about what that's like?
It's fulfilling. It's very fulfilling. You never stop learning about the world. I feel like that you work in the theater, you work in any art, you're a student of humanity, you know, and you are always trying to dignify the human experience through your art, I feel. And I think if you always, I think all true artists would say that that's exactly what they do. So it's fulfilling. It's a fulfilling life.
You know, that's an interesting thing to say. I'm not sure I've heard anybody else say exactly that, to dignify the human experience.
Yeah.
Maybe you can't make it more specific, but can you add to that at all?
Well, I mean, I would say just in the current thing with The Chosen, you know, you're dignifying the Jewish people. You're dignifying their experience having to deal with the atrocities of World War, and how do you move forward in life, you know? How do you deal with that?
So you're saying that you're presenting from the perspective of the person whose the play is about.
Yeah.
So you get an opportunity. It's kind of like, you know, don't judge anybody until an Indian until you walk in his moccasins. It's like you get an opportunity to... Is that what you're saying, or I'm putting words in your mouth?
I always... like this morning when we were rehearsing, I told my cast, I said, there's something I always tell cast when I direct a show, and I say, we have to figure out the point of why we're telling the story. We can't just say we were hired to do this play and we're producing it and it's got dates on a calendar. You can't do that. You have to, I always ask cast, I always say, why are we asking audience members to pay $50, let's say, to sit in a theater and listen to a play? Why are we asking them to do that? So what? So we have to be very sensitive, to use that word again, we have to be sensitive to why do we tell the stories. And I think it's, you have to be very much so, it's to try to change the world, and try to change perceptions and give dignity to the human experience.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. It's a great place to stop. Thank you so
much,
Scott.
Thank you.
This is a very fulfilling career. A career in which he gets to explore human dignity, to show us with his work what it means to be a human. And Scott is lucky. He gets to do this in every conceivable way in the theater. He not only directs, but he writes from his own experience and also on assignment. He stage manages, so he can help bring work that is or isn't his own to the stage. And he acts. There's every way that you can participate in the work of theater, as Scott has been able to do, and to do very quickly, as we said, and as you certainly know, if you know anything about the theater, it's unusual to be working as much as he is right out of school. So, of course, what this means, and neither one of us said it in the interview, but what it means is that he's really good at what he does. And so I hope that if you are in or around or near or intending to be in or around or near St. Petersburg during the time that The Chosen is running, that you will run down there. If you get there on opening night, you get to see me, because I will be there. Okay, so as I said in the beginning of the show, and as I say in every show, I play these interviews with people who make their living or their life. Not just people who are actually making a living doing it, because that's rare in and of itself, but people who are giving their life to it, people who are working in community theater where they don't get paid, people who are painting in their studio, hoping to sell, but not necessarily, people who are putting together cabaret acts, working in cabaret, but not actually making a living doing it, dancers, fine artists, architects, anybody who has given their life to an art. And I do this because we make it so difficult for artists in this culture. As Scott said, and I have said, and just about everybody I've interviewed has said, this is not a culture that really supports its artists. So if you want to make a living with an art, if you fell in love with singing or dancing or writing or acting or drawing or painting or any of those arts, the possibility of your being able to make a living is, well, sketchy. I don't know if you were listening a couple of weeks ago when I interviewed Sarah Morsi, who was in Collected Stories at the Banyan in Sarasota, Florida. But Sarah says that in one of the knockdown dragouts she had with her parents, who were trying to dissuade her from making this her life, her mother said, "You know, how can you be an actor? You have a house full of furniture." It's that idea that it is somehow not normal, not legitimate to be an artist. It's okay to do it on the side. It's okay to do it as an avocation. It's okay to do it as a hobby, but not to give your life to it. But those people who give their life to it are people who do it because it is who they are. And if you heard Sarah's really extraordinary interview, she says that she saved her life doing it. And I've heard this over and over again. There isn't anything else I could do. I do this because I can't help it. Yes, I know. I have friends who have houses. I have friends who have bank accounts. I don't, but I wouldn't do anything else. So I interview these people to give you an opportunity to hear what it sounds like when you are inextricably yourself. And it is my hope that you are inspired to ask yourself, am I inextricably myself? Can I say that what I do for a living, that what I do day in and day out is fulfilling, that it makes me feel at peace, at one, at home with myself, that I am myself? or what is true for so many people, not everybody, of course. And I'm not saying, and I want to make this very clear, I am not saying that one has to be an artist in order to feel that one is oneself. No, I think any occupation, any avocation, any way in which you spend your life, if it is you, then that's okay, that's fine, that is what I would want for you. You're a parent, and that fulfills you. You're an accountant, and that feels great. You love numbers. You were always amazed at the way numbers always came out the same. You love the security of the fact, the consistency of that. You fell in love with the stars when you were very young, and so astronomy or astrology, turned you on, and that is what you have given your life to, whether you make a living at it or not. Again, it is not the thing. It is that it is you. And it is not only what you do with your days, how you fill your days, but it is who you are within those days. Are you someone who can spontaneously say what is on his or her mind? Are you someone who isn't second-guessing his or herself? Are you someone who is not vigilant, worried all the time about what may or may not happen? Are you someone who is at peace, at ease, at one? When you are with other people, are you the same person that you are when you're at home? When you're at work, are you the same person that you are with your family? When you are with your boyfriend, girlfriend, lover, spouse, are you the same as you are with your friends? Are you the person that you are with your friends, with your family? Is there one person that you are and always are and are okay with, are happy to be? So if the answer to any of this is no, I can't be who I really am with my family, or I can only be who I really am with my family, and I can't be that person with my friends, or my boss, or my colleagues. Or are you, as one client of mine told me, I'm one person with, he worked in construction and real estate development, and he said he was one person with the people that he worked with in development, and he was a different person entirely with the people in construction. He had these many personas, and he would move from one to another. Well, this is fine, except that it didn't feel good. It felt like he was never himself, that he didn't actually know who he was. And there were lots of opportunities for him to betray himself, to not be himself, to not get what he would have wanted, and to not demonstrate who he really was. So if this sounds familiar to you, if you are experiencing sadness or loneliness or depression because you can't be yourself, lots of people say, I can't decide if I liked a movie until I hear what my husband, my sister, my children, my boss said about this movie. So do you know who you are? Are you that person in every situation? Well, if you're not, and you know it, and you'd like to be more of it, it is not impossible and it is not too late. But as I said in the beginning, it is also not simple. It's not a question of, oh yeah, right, I'm not doing that, let me do that now. Because as I said and say whenever I talk about this, when you try and recover those pieces of yourself which you had to deny, all of the reasons that you had to deny them come up and say, oh no, be careful, don't, it's dangerous. So this is very hard to do on your own. And as you know, if you've been listening to me, this is one of the things that psychotherapy is about, helping people become themselves, or to use Scott's phrase, to have the dignity of being the human that you are. So if you have questions about that, if you want to talk about that, please go up on my website, thelinshow.com. I'll be very happy to hear from you, very happy to answer any questions that you have. As always, I hope that you got something from this show, something that inspired you, something that turned on your curiosity, something that made you want to explore yourself more deeply, or just something that made you want to go out and see The Chosen, but something that will bring you back. Because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten